Today on Straight Talk Africa, President Obama's African policy advances key strategic goals, strengthening democratic institutions, advancing peace, security, and development. Some U.S. lawmakers and the African diaspora are calling for a reassessment of U.S. African policy. That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America studios here in Washington. It's Wednesday, May 18th. I am Shaka Sali.
Happy Wednesday, Shaka, and hello to all our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Ayan Bior, your social media reporter.
Today, we'll talk about the need for a paradigm shift in U.S.-Africa relations.
And coming up later in our STA inbox, our audience has weighed in on our topic through emails and Facebook comments, and we'll reveal some of them ahead on Straight Talk Africa.
With Africa now a major front line in the global fight against terrorism, U.S. lawmakers and others are asking, is a fundamental change needed in U.S.-Africa relations? My colleague Paul Sisco has more.
The recent inauguration of Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has triggered a renewed U.S.-Africa foreign policy discussion inside the walls of the U.S. Capitol. Western delegations walked out of Mr. Museveni's inaugural proceedings over the attendance of Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir and Museveni's denouncement of the International Human Rights Court at The Hague that has charged Mr. Bashir with genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. Museveni is now into his fourth decade in power. Following the Ugandan presidential election, leading opposition candidate Kizza Besigye was arrested and now faces charges of treason, reportedly for declaring himself the legitimate winner of the election and being sworn in by a member of his Forum for Democratic Change party. President Museveni is one of several African leaders with questionable human rights and governance records that received considerable U.S. support because of his partnership with America in the fight against terrorism. Some Washington lawmakers and others are asking some tough questions.
My concern is, are we giving countries a free pass who are our partners in our counterterrorism campaigns on human rights and poor governance?
It's a challenge.
America's top diplomat on African affairs, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, would like to see more U.S. assistance for democracy building on the continent.
We condemn human rights abuses. We regularly condemn those abuses by security forces and by governments. And we make clear to these governments that this is a core value for the United States. At the same time, we are committed to firmly working with our partners to address efforts to defeat terrorism.
The United Nations Abdoulaye Mardier and Christopher Fomunyo of the National Democratic Institute say establishing security and good governance takes time and money.
First, you have to stop the bleeding, and then you can use democracy and good governance to build up a lot of these societies and a lot of these countries.
The toxic combination of poor governance, low human development, and weak social contract that has created this. And this will take time to deal with. It's a long-term investment.
America's counterterrorism partnerships in Africa have some U.S. lawmakers worried.
Al-Shabaab and its predecessors have long troubled Somalia and its neighbors in East Africa, including attacks on American embassies in 1998. Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb have evolved since 9/11 into a vicious regional threat across the Sahel and beyond. Boko Haram, which has declared allegiance to ISIS, will stop at nothing to carry out its grotesque attacks against civilians and communities across Nigeria.
Senator Bob Corker says terrorism breeds on instability and a complex set of conditions and factors.
The most egregious of which appears to be the complete lack of government responsibility for its citizens through corruption and greed, rather than any lack of resources.
Some ask, will America have to make a fundamental shift in its foreign policy towards Africa? And will the United States continue to support the leadership of those nations that have been accused of human rights abuses and governance malfeasance? Because they are key in the fight against global terrorism. Paul Sisko, VOA News.
Thanks, Paul, for that report. Now, joining us here in our Washington studios are two distinguished guests. Maria Burnett, senior researcher in the Africa Division at Human Rights Watch in Washington, D.C., and Sylvester Okele, DNC's African Diaspora Liaison, also based here in the nation's capital. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have to say I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you again on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you so much for having us.
You're most welcome. Where have you been, Maria? I haven't seen you in a very, very long time in this studio.
I've been in Uganda a great deal over the last year and in Kenya as well. I continue to manage our work on East Africa.
I remember, of course, meeting you very briefly at the Kampala Selena in the Ugandan capital.
Yeah, on the day of the announcement of the election results.
Yeah, that is correct. Okay, then what about you?
Well, thank you, my brother. It's good to be here again. This is a campaign season. We've been really busy with the campaign going on. We've got to get our people positioned.
Very interesting. Well, it's a pleasure, of course, to have you here, and I hope that we'll have a terrific discussion. Let me ask you a question. You just saw a package. Your reaction?
Well, I think these are important questions for the U.S. and U.S. legislators to be asking about what is the right foreign policy approach in Africa. Obviously, at Human Rights Watch, we're firmly committed to seeing all foreign policy be based in respect for human rights. And I think one of our concerns has been, particularly for Uganda, but in several other countries, has been that we've seen a real increase in support from the security assistance side and less support going to democracy and good governance work. And, you know, I think many of us would argue that that needs to be carefully thought through and that security assistance shouldn't overshadow the importance of human rights protections.
What about you, Sylvester?
First, I have to give honor to whom honor is due. I commend President Obama for the enormous work he's been doing supporting Africa and other nations of the world. I know that there are challenges in Africa, but the approach to solve those problems is where we need to pay attention. Some of the things we've invested money and resources, we need to kind of do a stock checking of what works and what needs to be revamped. I stay thanking for all the work being done, but more need to be done in order for us to have sustainability.
Maria, what about some who argue that you really can't do anything unless you have a country secured? A country that is experiencing at least some element of peace?
Well, I think there's no doubt that stability is important, but there's no reason to think that elections have to bring an end to stability. As President Obama has said, there need to be strong institutions, and that includes electoral commissions and parliaments and others who may well be a check on the power of the executive. So I think the goal is to have both.
The goal is to have both.
Human rights protections and stability, there's no reason to choose between the two.
They are not mutually exclusive.
Well, absolutely not. I mean, they absolutely shouldn't be, and they can't be for countries to flourish.
In fact, some say they should be mutually reinforcing.
Ideally, absolutely. I mean, I think we've seen, in Uganda, for example, there's been a lot of concern about failure of service delivery. So while some people are saying, well, there's peace, many people are saying, but we also don't have good quality access to health services. We have a cancer machine that is dysfunctional for many years. There's been a lot of complaints about access to health services and critiques of the education system as well. So it's not all about stability to the detriment of all other services. It's a package for everyone, and citizens have to have their basic rights protected. That means health. It also means the ability to express themselves, to the ability to freely associate and freely assemble.
But if you're a member of the Ugandan elite, of course, you have access to service delivery in South Africa, in Europe, or in North America.
And if you're a government official, sometimes at the expense of Ugandan taxpayers, tragically. Absolutely, it's a problem. Ugandans complain about it a great deal.
Very interesting. What about you, Sylvester?
I think there are a whole lot of stuff we need to focus on when it concerns Africa and human rights. First of all, is hunger. I think Bob Marley said that a hungry man is an angry man. Most of the human rights issue, when people are hungry, you got to first of all fill their stomach before you tell them how to wake up in the morning and when to go to work. So when you cannot provide them food and provide them certain things that they can live to with their family, take care of their children, every other thing you're telling them, you're just wasting your time. And I think that's a basic human right. And that is where we need to fight corruption seriously, because that is another human right that has been abused and is being supported, or what my president called a safe haven. We need to make sure that those individuals who commit those crimes are taken accountable, so that people, like talking about education, quality healthcare, and so on, those resources that are being siphoned can take care of those things. So when people have resources that they need, I don't think we should be having problem and complaining and so on. That's the number one human right that I would really protect or fight for, is resources.
You know, your president, of course, Major General Muhammadu Buhari,
Mr. Buhari,
retired but not tired, promised, frankly, that the first thing he would do is to make sure that, you know, he wipes out Boko Haram.
Yes.
How far has he gone so far?
You may have heard that this morning one of the kidnapped girls was, you know, discovered alive. So he'd been fighting. One thing I know about a general.
Out of 200.
Well,
in fact, more than 200.
At least he did better than Goodluck, who was there when they were kidnapped. So at least he'd been working intensively. And just last week, he had a regional security meeting and getting other neighboring countries to be secured and so on. First of all, that's another human right, having confidence, sense of confidence. When our girls, our daughters can walk on the street confidently, go to school. I remember in those days, my school take about 3-4 miles away. I mean, primary school, you have to go and walk home. No parent, no boss taking you or bringing you back from school. So in these days, with the Boko Haram, when our girls cannot come back to school from school safe, or our sons from school safe, we need to protect that. And I think the president is doing the best he can to secure the border so that opportunities can actually reach everywhere. He is doing a very good job, even though he cannot satisfy everyone. I remember when he came to Washington, D.C., he said they call him Baba Go Slow. He said, well, he assured everyone that he will continue to go slow but steady. So the man is going slow but very steady for the good of the country.
Maria, U.S. allies in East Africa, they have been partners in fighting, of course, against Al-Shabaab and all that kind of stuff. And frankly, they seem to be doing a reasonably good job. But what extent have they also, in a way, been turning that policy politically inside their own countries against their legitimate political opponents?
Well, I think Uganda is a good example of a country that's, I think, struggled with the balance between human rights protections and the security sector. You know, we've had a lot of concerns about human rights abuses committed by the Ugandan army domestically. I think the U.S. has tried in some cases to do careful vetting, although we would always argue for a better job there. There's a lot of questions around how well evidence of human rights abuses by individuals is gathered and what kind of coherence there is to that policy. You know, I think more and more we're seeing the Ugandan military deployed domestically in assemblies and demonstrations. We've seen a lot of tanks on the streets in Kampala in the last 3 or 4 months. It's a concern that the UPDF plays a very active role in domestic politics and is often there on the front lines of domestic disputes.
Very interesting. What about that? Does that also happen, for example, in some countries in West Africa?
Look, Africa problem is the same everywhere, regardless of a region, west or east and so on. But I think the approach or the methodology that I believe that need to be changed is the neglect of ethnic Africans. We all came here to learn, and we are the best resources to effect change in Africa. You know, dealing with the people over there is good, but when we have educated people, we have lawyers, doctors, highly educated people. Take an instance, 2 weeks ago at Howard University, and how many graduates of pharmaceutical doctors, at least 43 are Nigerians, Africans. And these are individuals that are highly learned that we can actually tap into to effect change in our country. In every African country, DRC, problems going over there. We have a lot of diasporans here that we can actually use in order to effect change in those countries. So those are the areas America need to look into very well. The billions and trillions of dollars invested is enough, but right now for us to start making use of the right tools, human powers, to be able to effect change in our communities.
Thank you. Now we'll pause for a short break, and would like to remind you that Straight Talk Africa is now on the social networking website Twitter, and we are tweeting live. Follow us at VOA Shaka. That's VOA Shaka. I'm joining in on today's discussion with your questions and comments. Don't forget to use the hashtag VOA US Africa Relations. And we are still on Facebook. Just enter the keywords Straight Talk Africa. Become a fan and connect with other friends of the Voice of America. We'll be right back with you, so please don't go away.
Like Voice of America on Facebook. Follow VOA on Twitter. Join VOA on our YouTube channel. Like, follow, join VOA.
Today's youth are not just the next generation of African leaders, they are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them. Today, not tomorrow. So let's connect, let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies. Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known. It's Upfront every Wednesday, 1730 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Welcome back, and of course, this is Straight Talk Africa coming to you live from Washington. Let me come to you immediately, Maria. You saw in the package Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni being sworn in, talking about the ICC in manners some, in fact, have judged to be perhaps undiplomatic, and Western ambassadors marched out. Your reaction?
Well, I think it's an impressive move. It was more than just the United States. It was the EU. It was many Scandinavian countries. It was Canada. So first of all, many of the countries that walked out are parties to the Rome Statute and have made that commitment to fight for accountability for mass atrocities. The U.S. is not a party to the Rome Statute. We at Human Rights Watch clearly believe that they should ratify that. But they have an Office of War Crimes Prosecution, and the U.S. has worked quite a bit on pushing for ICC prosecution. So, you know, I can see the value in the U.S. and other countries taking the stance that President Museveni appeared to mock victims of mass atrocities by calling the ICC useless people and felt that they couldn't stomach the event.
So you think the march out was symbolically significant?
I think particularly for the countries who are party to the Rome Statute, they saw that as living up to their obligations. And I think for the United States, you know, we can argue about whether or not the U.S. has moral authority. Clearly, Human Rights Watch believes the U.S. should be doing a great deal more, including prosecuting many Americans for crimes against humanity and war crimes for certain events from our past. But that being said, I think it's important to stand up with victims of mass atrocities and say that we believe there should be accountability, that President Bashir should go to The Hague, have a fair trial, be able to fight that case, and see what happens in a fair trial there.
You mentioned, of course, how the U.S. Senate has never ratified the Rome Statute. But what about the fact that during the George W. Bush administration, they went ahead and came up with this Article 98, which is allows them to get into bilateral agreements with countries not to arrest an American citizen if that citizen should have committed, for example, crimes against humanity and that kind of stuff. And guess what? The first few countries, in fact, to have signed on that treaty were Rwanda, Uganda, and Ethiopia.
Yeah, it's a problem. There's no doubt about it. I mean, at Human Rights Watch, we talk a great deal about accountability. We spend a great deal of time and resources talking to victims of serious crimes. And we believe firmly that crimes should be prosecuted. Now, it's important to flag that the ICC is a court of last resort. So it's a place where crimes and court and cases end up when countries are unwilling or unable to prosecute. It's not the first place to go. So clearly in the case, for example, of Bashir, the argument goes there that Sudan is clearly not willing or able to prosecute him, and that has been the push. President Museveni was a supporter of the ICC. He was the first president ever to refer a case there. And clearly we saw that cases, indictments were issued against members of the Lord's Resistance Army. There's a case pending right now against one of the commanders of the Lord's Resistance Army. So we have seen leaders from East Africa want and push for accountability when it suits them. The challenge is that you can't just pick and choose when you like accountability. Either you believe in it or you don't. And sometimes that means you're going to have to push for cases that may not be politically expedient for you or your administration.
It's very interesting because when you mentioned President Yoweri Museveni, he obviously happens to be one of the founding signatories of the Rome Statute. Nobody put an AK-47, frankly, on his head. He did it voluntarily. But perhaps he did it because it could take care of some of his political adversaries or people that he basically didn't want to do business with. There is a time when he said, for example, that if Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir overflew in the Ugandan airspace, he would apprehend him and send him to The Hague. So what happened? Now he, in fact, invites him to the big party.
Yeah, I don't think I could start to even speak to what President Museveni may have been thinking in recent times. He's obviously spoken a great deal about accountability. He frequently argues that he holds his soldiers to account, but I think it's clear that the inauguration flies in the face of a great deal of what he's said in the past. So it's a travesty for victims of the Lord's Resistance Army War, for the situation in Darfur, you know, to think that those victims may not get a day in court because this president has chosen to not send President Bashir to face the case against him. I think it's a tragedy. And I think President Museveni should have ensured that President Bashir could face his day in court.
Interesting. Sylvester, there are 9, I think, cases, in fact, at The Hague as we talk. And 6 of these were referred to The Hague by African governments themselves, and 2 by the Security Council. Is there perhaps, should there be a different standard for ordinary Africans when it comes to the ICC, and a different standard for presidents in Africa when it comes to the ICC, when in fact they commit crimes against their own people?
First, there is no, no one is above the law. But I want to refer to the first question to my colleague here, Museveni and the ambassadors walking off. First of all, it's disrespect on Africa, because if African ambassadors has walked off, then that will amount to announcing of an embargo on African countries. So, and we need to start facing reality and accountability. Most of the atrocities committed in Africa, and those committing it have their counterparts outside. For instance, Paul Manafort, who is now Donald Trump's campaign manager, he was representing most of the dictators that has really destroyed Africa, including our former, my Nigerian former president, Sani Abacha. Go and Google it. Paul Manafort was the one lobbying and representing them. Just like the existing human rights abuse and corruption going on in Africa today, they have their colleagues, their networks, their allies that are promoting and, you know, advocating for them. So this is where the diasporans, the ethnic Africans, are needed seriously to be able to govern their people or also make decisions on policies that affect Africa. We are not at the table. And because of money, this is politics and interest. Most of these countries and nations go there because of what they have in common. So, but when we have someone like you, someone like me, or millions of Africans who are here being at the table during making decisions and policies, we should be able to say this is what we want. That's why I love President Uhuru's comment, although it was on a different context. But when he said that you cannot give to the people what they themselves do not want. So it is time for us to start, if we really want transformation in Africa, growth in Africa, to start using the diasporans. We know America, we know there, so we stand in a better chance to get the change over there. Coming on who gets to be reprimanded or not, nobody's above the law. You know, recently, I used Nigeria as an example. Someone posted that if President Buhari arrests President Goodluck Jonathan, there will be anarchy. Say what? Why wouldn't he arrest him if he was there sitting down and all the monies are going out and today everybody is crying? They didn't know that the money, the country is going to be empty. They didn't know that fathers will be suffering, mothers will be suffering, children will be suffering. So when those things were happening, who are we supposed to hold accountable? Let him come and answer the question. Likewise, any country in Africa, anybody in Africa, any corporation in Africa, no matter how million you have, whatever you have, if you commit such crime and you're found wanted, they need to arrest the person, let them face the music.
How important is the African diaspora here in terms of lobbying and perhaps influencing policies that help for the United States to interact with African countries?
Thank you. And that is what we are working on. We have a new organization called United People for African Congress. That's to enable us to come to the table. We have too many voices. And you know, if three of us are talking, no one's going to pay attention. Now we need to start coming to the table, every one of us, recognizing ourselves. Inclusivity is very, very important. That's one thing I respect President Obama so much. If you recall, during his campaign, he talked about inclusiveness, getting everybody together. And that's why he won and won massively. So people don't know that that's a very big secret. Like this other one who is shouting about throwing people back to where they come from. But he forgot that those people you are throwing back are the people who make America strong. I can't imagine when the media have focused so much narrating those who came here to pick fruits and so on, but they forgot those who made the farm, those who build our railways and all the resources that come. So we need to focus on the diaspora, and all we diaspora need to come together. You know, we need to stop grumbling, we need to stop agonizing, but we need to start organizing ourselves so that we can position ourselves to better pay attention to what is going on back in Africa. We have a lot of responsibility right there. By coming together, it doesn't matter whether you speak English, you speak French, you're Christian, you're Muslim, we are one Africa. President Obama said the future of Africa is in the hand of Africans. And it is time for them to respect that word and start involving Africans here to be able to make decisions. You can't write policy on Africa when there is no African there. I mean, you cannot say you are drafting a policy on Africa when you have no African leader there, ethnic African, who can tell you that this thing favors my people or not.
Well, there is no African sitting on the table.
Thank you. Now we are pushing, we are asking that we want to be at the table. And we want that acknowledgement. We want that welcome. And that's why I love the Democratic Party, not because I represent the Democratic Party, but that has been the only party that has given us the enabling playing field, that has welcomed us to come to the table.
You know as well as I do that the single largest recipient of American aid in the world is the state of Israel. Mm-hmm. Israel has really very few people.
Because of organization.
Compared, of course, to the continent of Africa, which boasts about 1.25 billion people. You know why Israel is what it is? Because of the Jewish community in the United States.
Yes.
In terms of about lobbies and influences, the manner in which Washington interacts with Tel Aviv.
And the way they manage themselves. You see, not that every community have one problem or the other, but we take our own problem as if we are the only one with problem. I always tell people this, God bless Africa, we are the most diverse continent in the world, but many of us see our diversity as our impediment, as our challenge, our problem. But that's a unique thing God has done there, if we can bring ourselves together. Israel, you mentioned, they work together, they are able to manage the affairs of Israel. If we can work together, forget about differences, forget about political... I mean, after election, when someone has been elected and sworn in, for the interest of the entire community, we need to work together and make sure we sustain him. If you don't like him at the election time, you vote him out, and that's what I personally do. I might work with you, promote you, do everything, but when it comes to election, I will analyze if I want you again or if I don't want you again.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, you are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment. But first, here is Ayen Bior. Ayen, take it away, please.
Thanks, Shaka. And still to come, we'll reveal some of the fantastic feedback we received from our audience through social media. But now, here's our letter of the week from a Straight Talk Africa Facebook fan. Our letter of the week comes from Martin Manuel Rugol in Juba, South Sudan. He writes, "There is no need to improve America's relations with Africa. I believe American leaders have taken advantage of the senseless wars fought in Africa. The cause of Africa's wars have come as a result of regime change initiated by the American government."
A I wanted to present music and a side of American culture that is most important to me, that is a part of who I am. They're gonna get some incredible performances. That's one of the things I love, bringing these artists in so you can get to see them do what they do. It's soul music, and that's what music is. It's that which comes from the soul.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on the Voice of America. For more information, visit our website at www.voanews.com/African Beat.
Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. Once again, it's time to bring in my colleague and social media reporter, Ayen. Take it away again, Ayen.
Thanks again, Shaka. We received tremendous feedback in our STA inbox to this week's question. U.S. lawmakers examining the threat that terrorism poses in Africa have expressed concerns that America may be overlooking human rights and governance abuses by regional leaders who provide assistance on counterterrorism issues. This leads us to our question of the week, which asks, what changes, if any, should be taken to improve U.S.-Africa relations? Well, before we begin, I'd like to thank all of you for using our social media platforms to communicate with us. And another reminder that we are tweeting live today. Use the hashtag VOAUSAfricaRelations. And if you haven't yet, please do follow us at VOA Shaka. And speaking of, let's go to a tweet from Ikachele, who writes, by preventing mainstream terrorist groups like IS from spreading in Africa, the U.S. will help Africa have peace. And we have another tweet from Michael Gutwitch, who writes, help build strong institutions, especially independent judiciary and an army that is not attached to the ruling party or rulers. And our last tweet is from RPD2610, who writes, we don't need aid, but rather oust Museveni, Nkurunziza, Kabila, Mugabe, and the remaining dictators in West Africa. Now let's go over to Facebook, where our Facebook fan Owera Walter writes from Uganda, African leaders should avoid overstaying in power past their elected term limit in order to improve and maintain good relations with the United States. Well, Shaka, a few thought-provoking points made. What's your take?
Very interesting. Maria, your reaction?
Well, those are all interesting points. I certainly believe it's important for armies to be distinct from their presidents. The best-case scenario is that the president can perform his role in the executive function, and the armies can concern themselves with broader security questions without being beholden to a specific leader. I do think that that's a critical point for human rights protections in pretty much all countries around the world.
Very interesting. What about you, Sylvester?
Yeah, I second that, but I keep emphasizing it is important for us to start making use of what we know, fighting with the weapons we already know. Looking at the colonialist period, someone like Frederick Lugard, you know, one of his weak points was his inability to delegate authority.
Captain Lugard.
Frederick Lugard, yeah. The British...
The man that introduced indirect rule.
Thank you.
So his inability
to delegate authority was one of the problems, because you have to start making use of the ethnic leaders so they'll be able to communicate back to you. And that refers to what I said in the beginning. We need the ethnic groups. We need all together. Coming together is the key. The Bible even said that cannot be taken care of without multitude counselors. So when we come together with different advices, that will help us to rule our nation. So I second that contribution.
Ayen, do you have any more feedback from our audience, please?
Yes, we have just a couple more. Let's go to a comment from Facebook fan Ina Muhumuza Sent, who writes, the United States should leave Africa's issues to Africans. For example, why are they concerned over Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni's comments on the International Criminal Court when actually they are not a part of the ICC? And our last Facebook comment comes from Masareka Clovis, who writes, if African countries fight against corruption to the best of their ability, then the U.S.-Africa relationship will stand strong. Well, Shaka, it's hard to disagree with that. Your take.
Very interesting, Maria. The first, especially the first piece suggests that when he says they are not members of the ICC, maybe you could, in fact, correct that impression. That, well, in fact, a majority of those who walked out at Kororo are, in fact, signatories and members of the Rome Statute.
Yeah, many European countries did walk out of President Museveni's inauguration last week. As we said, Canada and other Scandinavian countries. So the decision by some of the diplomatic community to walk out was not the U.S. alone, although I think it is important that the U.S. Does participate in dialogue with its EU partners, given that they are all participating in providing security assistance and support to civil society in Uganda.
Very interesting. What about that, Sylvester?
The reason we do all this is for sustainability, so that our kids will take over from where we start, from having a good life. But obviously, it's all about politics and interest. But if we can keep interest and politics aside and focus on building lives there, we have multitude that are languishing, that are struggling. So I think it is time for the U.S. to really send us out. And as a big U.S. have been catering for the whole world, spending a lot of money. But how about spending all of those money, you look at it in the end of the year, there is no effectiveness in it. And that is what is happening. Ebola happened, the U.S. arrested it. Terrorism is going on, the U.S. arrested it. The last comment talk about corruption. Corruption and terrorism requires global attention, because Africa is crying, Africa is depressed today because a lot of resources have been stolen. And where are they? Not in Africa, overseas. So, and that's the reason why I believe the Western world pay no attention to that. If they can help African governments to recover all those things, Africa will be strong. A hungry man remains an angry man.
Pay attention next week to the Panama Papers. Well, Ayen, thanks very much for bringing us this week's audience reaction.
It's my pleasure, and that does it for today's social media segment. Just a reminder that we appreciate all the feedback, whether it's in social media form or using other means to communicate with us. Please keep them coming. And if you're a new fan, do drop us a line at AfricaTV at voanews.com. Once again, our email address is AfricaTV@voanews.com. Or post your comments on our Facebook page. Enter the keywords Straight Talk Africa. And be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com. Or you can join our YouTube channel. Sign up to VOA TV to Africa. And follow us on Twitter at @VOAShaka. A reminder that the show is streaming live every Wednesday. Go to VOA Straight Talk Africa TV program page on our website. Or simply watch us live on your mobile device. Just download the VOA mobile app. Now let's take a look at what's on tap for next week's program. Next week on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the Panama Papers. Join host Shaka Sali, his panel of guests, and me, Ayen Bior, your social media reporter, as we talk about the Panama Papers controversy. That's next week on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Ayen, and welcome back. Today we'll talk about, of course, the need for a paradigm shift in U.S.-Africa relations. Our distinguished guests are Maria Burnett, senior researcher in the Africa Division at Human Rights Watch in Washington, D.C., and Sylvester O'Kelly, the NEC's African Diaspora Liaison, also based here in the nation's capital. Well, ladies and gentlemen, again, of course, I have to say I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly gratified to host the two of you again on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you, Shaka.
You're most welcome. Let me take you, O'Kelly, a little bit back. You talked about how Africa, yes, it may be diverse, but you know, it can actually come together when the need arises. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, that when you look at those 54 different countries across the continent, you know that they have leaders where almost each of them, obviously there are a few exceptions, pretty much does his thing, using the family as the key, or the ethnic community and all that kind of stuff. To what extent is that reflected in the African diaspora that lives in America, for example?
Thank you. Frankly, that's the best question I'm taking now, because that's what I represent from state of Maryland to nationally. Tango for the Democratic Party, I keep saying it because the platform they gave us, and also it is good for the government itself to recognize that and help us to work together, because this is the key. If Africans in the diaspora can work together, it's a reflection to the people back home that Nigerians, Cameroonians, Kenyans, East, West, North are working together. Our people back home should be able to embrace themselves and see themselves as one. For instance, Nigeria, if Igbos, Yoruba, Hausa, Christian, and so on work together, is a message to those back home to work together, because we are resemblance. And that is where it is needful to use us as means to communicate and to deliver services that is required back there. So it is important, because we are holding ourselves. The longer we keep working individually, the more we hold ourselves. We're making noises, we're not letting the lawmakers hear us clearly, because you are talking, I'm talking. But when we come together, bring our needs together, work together, they should be able to pay attention to us. Then we say Africans are speaking. But because you go, you are speaking in behalf of so-so-so diaspora, there are millions or thousands of African organizations in the country. But what are the need for all those? What has it done for us? There are many NGOs, African NGO-owned NGOs in the country. What has it done for us? We need to start coming together. We have the number, but our number has not been translated to opportunity for us, because we are working individually. Our number is not even identified or well-known, because we choose to work. Everybody wants to, you know, have his ego. Egos are good, but when we, you know, harness it. I was invited to speak at the Nigerian Diaspora Organization a few weeks ago, and they gave me a topic, which is harnessing our natural resources. The morning that I went there, I told them on the stage, I'm not speaking about harnessing the resources, because we already know our resources, but harnessing our potentials, our talents.
You see, a lot of people talk about how they are Pan-Africanist. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to their lifestyle and the kinds of things they do, frankly, they end up perhaps becoming Igbo.
Thank you.
To what extent would you say, frankly, that Africans living outside of the continent have graduated to the level of, in fact, becoming Africans, therefore moving a little bit out of their community, out of their ethnic cocoons? Because I can tell you for sure that, for example, I am a Mchiga from Kabale, southwestern Uganda.
Yeah.
But because of living here and the kind of experience I have had in terms of interacting with all sorts of people, I have in fact ended up becoming a true African. I consider my tribe, for example, if there is such a thing, my ethnic community, as African. But when you meet people that you grew up together, they have different experiences.
Yes.
You have no budget, they have budgets.
Thank you. That is why we need to... This is an education. This is a conversation that we need to promote. That's why we have United People for African Congress, UPAC, to bring us together. And thank God for the leadership there. We have Uganda, we have Tanzania, we have Mali. All African countries, we are on the table. Recently, on February 22nd, we convened a meeting through the DNC, helping us to facilitate that at the White House. And it was a very impressive gathering of African diaspora leaders, 180 African leaders from different countries in the United States, states in the United States, and representing different African countries and organizations. That is what is needed for us to be able to get the attention of politicians, and for us to, you know, reclaim our voice, and for us to be able to clear forcefully and positively for our country. Talking about policy, we should be the one drafting policy. Everyone bring your idea, what you think that affect your community, and we'll be able to bring it. And when we deliver that to governments back home, they have no reason to resist it, because we are here as an ambassador. That's what we are. You know, when I used to work in Nigeria immigration, there's what we call expatriate. Sometimes I used to think expatriate is someone who has too much knowledge.
Right.
But that's not what it means. It's someone who is working in a foreign land. We are here as expatriates, but nobody treats you the way they treat expats in Africa, provide all amenities, transport, security, and everything. Worship them as a second god. And could maybe someone who didn't even graduate from high school, but has some knowledge. So we need to start knowing who we are, that we didn't just come here by chance. We came here to learn, and we've learned enough to be able to help our people. That's why there is suffering. President Clinton said that Africa or Nigeria is suffering from brain drain. We have those brain here, helping to build this country. And it's good for the country to help us, harness us, so that we'll be able to help them do what they want to do in Africa.
You know, it is very interesting because I have experienced certain situations where I am in Nigeria, for example, and my fans, in fact, look at me as one of them. Mm-hmm. I am in Ghana, and it is the same thing. I'm in Kenya, I'm in Tanzania, and you name it, nobody even thinks about or worries about whether, in fact, I come from Kabale. So I think it is doable.
And that's why I like your show.
Frankly,
this speaks very distinctively to Africans. Everyone talk about your show. So we need to start promoting who we are, celebrating who we are. If the reason is because Africans, we hate to appreciate ourselves. Same thing with our leaders. When they come here, they're looking for a journalist. They will prefer to look for Larry King where he is. But they know you are doing, and you communicate directly than Larry King. You understand? So that is the problem we have. We tend to look for something foreign, and we need to start decolonizing our mentality.
Well, Jute Koros, a reminder that you are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll continue our discussion in a moment. So please, don't go away.
We are able to touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
If you like today's show, please write and tell us what you think or give us some suggestions. Be sure to tell us what station you're tuned into. Our address, Straight Talk Africa, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or send us an email at africatv@voanews.com. Log on to our website at voaafrica.com. Or post your comments on Facebook, keywords Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Githui Ewart, and of course, welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, coming to you live from Washington. Let me come to you, Maria, my sister from New York. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Terrific, terrific. You know, we've been talking about African leaders doing all sorts of things, frankly, with no endorsement from their people, the primary stakeholders of their countries. But they say, of course, power belongs to the people and comes from the people. Mm. Now, when these leaders, each of them, hold an election, whether it is flawed or free, fair, and credible, and what have you, there is a very important piece of document that they swear to defend, protect, and preserve. Why can't they be held accountable to that pledge by the international community in the same way as the international community now cannot accept the legitimacy of a military coup?
Yeah, well, I mean, ultimately, I think it's for the people and for the parliament of that country to insist that the leadership hold to that constitution. I don't think it's likely or even proper for the international community's voice to be louder than the will of the people in the country that we're talking about. That being said, what we frequently see is very questionable legislative processes that bring forward these kinds of constitutional changes, whether it's corruption and bribery, whether it's intimidation, whether it's violence. That is, you know, all constitutions are living documents. They can be amended as they are in all countries around the world. But the process by which those changes occur and to what extent human rights abuses mark that process and mar that process is, I think, really critical. You know, we spend a great deal of time documenting violations of free expression. A lot of people that we at Human Rights Watch interview say, I cannot speak freely about this issue without being afraid of reprisals, without facing a problem from a local government official. Mm. It's very difficult for the will of the people, quote unquote, to be communicated in many contexts. And I will say, unfortunately, we still see a lot of leaders, at least in the region that I work on, playing with ethnic politics. And ultimately, that is hugely divisive and creates its own problems down the line.
Well, there are situations, somebody will tell you, that these development partners or donor communities, they do have enormous power. As a matter of fact, there is a bit of evidence on the ground that a lot of these elections, especially in some African countries, are really held to appease development partners as opposed to the primary stakeholder, their own people, because their people really are not citizens. they are subjects to these guys in the State House. In the past, we have had experiences where, for example, the United States put its feet down and said, Ukraine, that is not an election. You have to have another election. Mm-hmm. And it happened, and you had another president. They said, Ivory Coast. Ah, come on, Laura Babo. No, you didn't win. The guy that won is Alassane Ouattara. And it happened. Babo now is in The Hague. Why can't we have that in questionable elections like Uganda, for example?
Well, I mean, clearly that's been hotly contested, and Dr. Bezige's call for an international audit has led him to be charged with treason. So I think it's very unlikely that we'll see an audit of Uganda's recent election.
Why? We have had audits, for example, in Afghanistan not a long time ago. We had international audits in Haiti, in Kosovo. Why not Uganda?
Well, it's not to say that I'm not concerned. We documented a great deal of human rights abuse during Uganda's campaign and election. We issued reports about threats to free expression, free assembly, the unlawful use of tear gas, the excessive force of the security forces. So we remain very concerned that the election season was marked by human rights abuses. But clearly, the government has not chosen to entertain the notion of an international audit, despite the fact, I think most importantly, actually, it's that the local Ugandan electoral observers pointed out that the election was not carried out in a way that was free and fair. Obviously, the international observers have gained a little bit more attention, but domestic observers should have a great deal of credibility. They frequently see patterns of abuse and repression that international observers don't see, and they came to the conclusion that Uganda's election had serious problems. So, I think it would be interesting to see such an audit, but I can't say that it seems very likely in the current context where it's difficult to even debate whether an audit should happen, given that the person who's been pushing it is now behind bars and being charged with treason for even proposing the suggestion.
But in a sense, I think that also gives him a platform. Doesn't it give him a platform? Mandela at one time was in Robben Island.
Well, we'll have to see where things go with Dr. Bezige. The situation is certainly concerning insofar as, you know, the court processes that have been happening where he's been charged have been happening after hours, before hours. There's been a lot of misinformation about when he'll appear. He hasn't had access to counsel in his court sessions yet. So it's certainly a case to watch.
You know, Sylvester, this is very ironic. Because I remember when the Madiba, Nelson Mandela, died, I remember a speech by U.S. President Barack Obama. He talked about majority of the African leaders who were there to respect him and say farewell to him. Mm-hmm. They, in fact, back in their own countries, were doing the very same things that it took Mandela more than 27 years to fight and defeat.
Exactly.
What an irony.
That's a challenge. Sometimes, even as we talk about diaspora, there are so many diaspora that have gone there, I would say they're even worse or become worse than some of those leaders who were there. But we cannot overlook all those things. The question of picking and choosing, we should focus on the community, the citizens themselves. You know, there's a proverb that says, when two elephants fight, it's the grass that will suffer. So regardless of who is at fault and so on, we need to focus on the individuals, the ordinary people, who cannot afford to be there to decide for themselves, and looking up to the U.S., looking up to the Western world, looking up to those of us that are here to really raise their voice. Like I mentioned earlier on, DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, what is going on over there? We don't hear too much about it. And all of these things could be focused because of, you know, interest. If you are there, most of these policies and drafters and so on are drafting policies that will suit and create enabling environment to grow their business. But if we focus on the humanity, on the individuals that are going through a hard time, I think there should be transformation in the region. And that's what we need to work on, we need to pray on and give encouragement to that area. Democracy is what we want everywhere in Africa. And with true democracy, an opportunity for everyone. I guarantee you, we wouldn't be high. Even Boko Haram, ISIS, and so on, will become a non-issue because the people can feed themselves and pay attention to the future.
You know, when there was the condition of apartheid in South Africa, apartheid was perceived by Africans and indeed the entire human community later, international human community, as an evil. But it was an evil because it was one group of people oppressing another group of people. Mm-hmm. Does oppression really have color? Does it have geography? Does it have boundaries, really?
Yeah.
Right. Isn't oppression oppression?
Oppression, right.
Isn't something that is wrong, wrong? Why are we afraid, for example, to criticize African leaders who are our cousins?
Thank you.
Our brothers and sisters who are oppressing their brothers, their aunts, their uncles.
That's what I say every day. You know what? And I'm sorry to mention Nigeria again because we are representing the entire Africa. But I use Nigeria as an example where people are crying for the president, the economy, this and that. And I ask someone a question. We are complaining, but in the recent years, a few years ago, when those crooks were looting the money out, bringing them here, we were celebrating them. We were even hosting parties. We know them. We didn't cry that they're taking the money away. Now that there is no money for the current president to walk, we are now complaining and stoning him and crucifying him, shouting, crucify, crucify him. He's not the cause of the problem. The wealth and the resources have long ago been stolen and feature of the keys have been mortgaged. So why are we crying now? So that is the answer to your question. If we can be bold enough and call a spade, when we see those evil leaders that are doing wrong and come here and deceive the U.S. and the entire world as if they are doing good, and we keep quiet, we are not helping our community. Many of them have their private jets. They don't care about the local roads that even a mother cannot go to church or go to market. Why would they care? Because they are flying. Many of them don't care about the local hospitals there because they and their wives and children come to overseas to receive medical care. They don't care about the local schools that are broken because their children are all in overseas. Not even ordinary school. Yale and Harvard is their competition. So why would they care about the ordinary people? But we that are here, we encourage them. We even brag about them. You understand? So until our conscience begin to, you know, work on us that we call a spade and stop them, if we don't make this place uncomfortable for them, they will continue to do what they are doing. And our families will continue to suffer. Those we know. So I think we need to get ourselves, you know, awaken up so that we'll be able to stop this from, you know, extending.
Maria, what needs to happen so that an ordinary African citizen, frankly, can enjoy the benefits of freedom, which is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness?
Well, obviously that's a challenge not just for an ordinary African, but for an ordinary American, for an ordinary Frenchman, and an ordinary Italian. There's clearly a long fight ahead for basic human rights to be protected in all countries. I think the best case scenario for, you know, as far as the topic we've been discussing today, is that the U.S. has its interests, but I think the best case scenario is that it doesn't allow its own interests to end up permitting it to be complicit in abuses in Africa. There's no doubt the U.S. has interest in Africa, security interests, other interests, natural resource interests. It's going to be a player on the continent. And I think our position is that it must play a productive role when it comes to the protection of human rights. We've seen a lot of good rhetoric, good statements out of various officials of President Obama's administration, a lot of talk about the concern for human rights. What we need to see now is concrete action. That security assistance doesn't trump the domestic human rights situation in these countries.
Why do we continue holding fake elections, which U.S. policymakers sometimes refer to periodic elections? Mm-hmm. Why? Why not, in fact, perhaps invest that money in service delivery?
Yeah.
Why do we have to deceive ourselves, really?
Well, it's power. Everybody wants power. And the point is that they have not come to the realization that I am elected to serve, but they are elected to bully. Like our individual here who think that it's about power, about giving respect, humiliating and intimidating people. I don't see the difference between Donald Trump and African leaders. So, and we need to come to a point where we let them know, and we, the people, because you know what? We're still gonna be the one crying about it. We need to stop electing wrong people.
Well, you can only do that, of course, if you in fact indeed have an opportunity to elect somebody. Mm-hmm. Because some of these people elect themselves.
Thank you. Money.
By producing figures that are predetermined.
Thank you.
Well, on that note, thanks to our distinguished guests, Maria Burnett, Senior Researcher in the Africa Division at Human Rights Watch, and Sylvester Okele, DNC's African Diaspora Liaison. Thanks to our affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners, we thank you for tuning in. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning, Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not beta Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.